This is a replay of the Wednesday night, July 29th, WGN show. We started right at 10. If you don't hear yourself on it, it's because you didn't call. Oh, I hope you'll rectify that soon. We're live Monday through Thursday evenings from 10 to 1 Central. Dial 888-876-5593. My toll-free number from OneVoip. For the best deal and good customer service, it's OneVoip. Check them out at the number 1-VOIP.com. You'll be really glad you did.
Direct from the edge of the lunatic fringe, it's the Raleigh James Show.
I'm Raleigh James. We have 3 hours to spend together. If it's on your mind, well, you know the deal. It'll be on mine. And your requests, too. Yeah, we got the rest of Jimmy P's six-pack and Stan's two requests and hopefully some of yours as well. All right, so all that said, I look for things with the help of many of you, especially Bob. Yeah, Engineer Bob sends me terrific links of things that I would otherwise never think about. For instance, what did people do before eyeglasses? And, you know, we take so many things for granted, and of course it's not a new invention to say the least, but nonetheless, there were a lot of humans roaming the earth before they got around to it. And so what'd they do? Well, it's interesting. We know some things and not others. But as far as glasses similar to what we wear today, that goes to Pisa, Italy, around 1286, when a craftsman fastened a couple of lenses to a frame made of wood, or maybe bone, and that was the first actual eyeglasses. But so that's 1286. But this is not the first time that humankind realized that there was a problem when you couldn't see too well. What did our prehistoric ancestors do? Well, to some degree, of course, we don't know, and exactly how the sight impaired kept up with the pack in a group of hunter-gatherers, that's lost to history to some degree. But even with imperfect vision, and you know, if it's imperfect enough, yeah, if you're very, very nearsighted, you've got incredible close-up vision. So possible that they were steered toward craftsman's role for their ability to focus on detail. So very nearsighted, that usually had a plus side. Yeah, unless they were running from the enemy, so to speak. But long before the guy in Italy fastened lenses to a piece of wood or bone, they were working on this. And there's some evidence that this dates back to the Bronze Age. Glass and rock crystals, and there's something called the Nimrod lens, and they found that in Assyrian remains. Current-day Iraq, actually. Not known exactly what they were used for. Some say, well, it was just a magnifying glass. And it would go between 7 or 9 times the ones that were found. So that could be interesting. But the other thing is there were holes in them, like resting points, meaning that they could have been propped up in a way that allowed artisans to use their hands and look through them. And then there was a 5,300-year-old Egyptian ivory knife handle with carved microscopic figures, showing that the ancient Egyptians had a mean for providing vision enhancements other than the severely myopic. But we also have crystal lenses. A 2.3-gram convex was found in the tomb of a son of Chinese Emperor Liu. So that's first century. And as far as exactly what did that, hard to say. But my favorite was the ancient Romans. And there are some historians who say, well, they believe that emeralds and green gemstones would be a way to provide a visual aid. Well, maybe so, but it's more likely to have been the first sunglasses than necessarily anything for a true vision acuity. But Emperor Nero watched a gladiator event with the assistance of a smaragdus, an emerald gem. But as I say, that probably helped him block the glare more than see too clearly. And then there was water globes, which is interesting. A Roman philosopher, Seneca, described the magnifying effect of water in glass. Letters, however small and dim, are comparatively large and distinct when seen through a glass globe filled with water. Couldn't walk around with it, I don't think, but Pliny the Elder also noted lens-like qualities that resulted from combining elements, although he was actually looking for flammability as far as that goes, focusing the sun's rays through glass and all those kind of things. But interesting to note, mirrors, as far as that goes, where Seneca continued to write about this, saying there were mirrors that would increase every object's size that they reflect. Absolutely. Concave metal glass or crystal mirrors could be used to magnify smaller text. So certainly for the last 1,000 years or so, they were working on it. But the major development came in the 9th century with reading stones, curved glass surfaces used to magnify print. And that was discussed at length by Arab mathematicians. And in fact, Al-Haytham's 1021 Book of Optics pretty much detailed it fairly well, typically made from quartz, rock crystal, or beryl. Reading stones were fashioned in a plano convex with the flat side against the page of the book and the rounded side on top, giving a clear view of the lettering below. So there's actually, I think, one surviving example of that was found from the 12th century in Sweden in 1999. But it's interesting to note those things, because all the things that we take absolutely for granted, yeah, what do we do beforehand? All right, so enough of that. Now, if it's on your mind, it'll be on mine. And right now, it is on Elizabeth's mind in Rock Falls. Welcome back to WGN Radio. So last we talked while we mourned Mr. Chubbs. Mr. Chubbs selected a replacement for you. So how's it going?
Right. The little bandit, he is just a character, and he's so much fun. Okay. Whenever he hears the air conditioning come on, he runs over and lies on the vent where the cold air is coming out.
Smart. Okay. I don't blame him a bit. That's brilliant on his part. How big is he?
Well, he was 18 pounds when I got him, and I don't know what he is now.
Okay.
I haven't had him weighed.
Well, small enough to, fit on the vent. So that's nice.
No, he lies on it.
Yeah.
First his head.
Yeah.
And then he goes, crawls forward, and then the rest of him.
Yeah, that's terrific.
He was groomed today, and when the groomer brought him out, he said, "Bandit is a nice little gentleman."
Isn't that good to know? I'll tell you what, there are, online on the internet, there are tons of people grooming dogs, and some of them are anything but nice.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah, they're fun to watch, especially when they go after the groomer. But that wouldn't be fun for the groomer, to say the least. But so Bandon apparently can be groomed by almost anybody. Had his nails clipped as well.
He was just really good, and he looked really cute.
Good.
I had to go to Iowa City a couple weeks ago, and so I had to leave early in the morning. And I took him back to the lady who had been keeping him to stay overnight and for part of the next day. So he got there, and she, all of a sudden, here's the neighborhood coming. We want to see Bandit. Is Bandit here yet? We want to see Bandit.
Oh, that's great. That's great. He had a welcoming committee.
Yes, and he was so happy to see everybody again. And so So, I don't know. He's a jolly little boy.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And it's perfect because you've given him the gift of life. You've saved him. And he's given you a lot of joy. So, that's a wonderful trait.
Right. I wanted to tell you about my experience at the grocery store last week and this week. This is probably nothing new to many of you people, but here it was something new. I came around that corner of the aisle at the grocery store, and right in front of me is this tall robot standing there.
I love it.
And he looked at me, he saw me, and he turned around and went the other way.
Now,
so I asked what in the world he's doing, and they said, well, it's one of them is named Tally, and the other one is Barney. And right now they're going through the store mapping everything. And then their job will be to keep roaming around and finding what shelves need to be stocked.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, see, here I thought they were going to have like samples of something, like hold out a platter for you to check out.
No. He does not interact with customers, it says.
Yet.
He's 79 inches tall.
Okay.
And just a tall, slim column with a base of wheels.
Well,
and some kind of a face kind of thing.
Yeah, Tally is actually the brand name of Simbi Robotics. And there's Marty, that's Badger. So they are actually being sold to supermarkets for inventory scanning, like you say. Also, spill hazard detection.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah, and some of them can do floor cleaning, which is really good. So, but the purpose is probably that inventory tracking, which is great. I wonder at what point they'll be able to restock the shelves themselves.
Well, I don't know. He doesn't have any arms.
Well, that's this model, but I'm sure that the robotics companies are working on them.
Well, I know. It's scary in a way.
Yeah.
How many jobs might be lost. But.
Well,
then this week I saw it again.
Yeah.
And I said, hello. And I could swear it said, hello, back to me. And I'm probably
It might have. Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, anything with an AI chip at this time, for the most part, is scarily designed to be friendly. And that's why when I'm smart enough not to ask AI about obscure R&B oldies. Forget about it. However, if I've got some computer questions that are driving me a little crazy, I'd say 7 times out of 10, AI will get me what I need and quickly. But what's a little off-putting is how personable it is. And, of course, you know, you're talking to a machine, but it makes you feel like the warmth of talking to a person. And every time I interact with that, I think to myself, I can see how people are, you know, falling in love with something on the internet that's not real and all that. They're almost a little too well programmed for that. It might be a little better if they were a little more mechanical. But they're wishing you a good evening and they're telling you how brilliant you are and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if the robot would say hello to you.
I've heard that some of them are reprogramming themselves and hacking into other robots.
Well, okay, let's talk a little about this for a moment. There are things they can do, but everything that robotics and artificial intelligence does at this point in time is still a deductive reasoning model. There is absolutely no inductive reasoning. So the idea like HAL, you know, from 2001 or something is going to come and take over, that's not the model or how they're programmed. But the deductive reasoning is so fine-tuned that there's associative reasoning and other things, but it still all comes back to deduction. And that's what keeps us safe.
It's scary to me.
Yeah, well, if I find out while I'm still roaming the planet, and hopefully I'll be gone, that they've made that leap to inductive reasoning, then I'm with you. I'll be scared all the way. But with deductive reasoning, it's just a sophisticated form of garbage in, garbage out.
But I don't think we know the whole plan of what's going on. I think there are things going on we don't know about where they are.
Well, from what I can tell, they're not there yet. And I've really spent some time researching this, actually, because like you, it was a little off-putting. And I think they can be there. I think we're probably less than 10 years away from it, but I don't have 10 years, so I'm not too worried.
But, you know, no, I don't either.
Yeah, right. So it's like, it's, okay, that's for some other generation. Yeah, oh, absolutely. And, you know, really, since the advent of digital technology, and we've been building up to this since the Industrial Revolution, really, that was all the precursor. All along, unfortunately, technology is ahead of wisdom. So when we get things, we're not necessarily bright enough to know what we shouldn't do with them. And so,
I know.
Yeah, that's, you know, that'll become a factor. But as far as the platforms now, they're strictly deductive.
Well, I got over my shock at seeing that thing.
I think that's great. No, I think that's great. And I wouldn't be surprised if the next generations are programmed to be more friendly to humans. And like I say, that's a little off-putting for people who don't understand the technology. But you know where that's really going to come in handy, and the customer will never see this, but all the warehousing, places like Amazon and stuff like that. Robotics for warehousing is it's already in place, but as it gets more fine-tuned, that absolutely will eliminate a lot of workers.
I would like one to do some housework for me.
Yeah, well, they make them. Now, you and I don't have the funds to buy one, the kind we want.
No,
but you know, and simple ones maybe, but the kinds we want, no, it's out of our reach. But they exist. So, yeah.
Well, it'll be a whole new world, I'm afraid.
At this point, you'll just have to settle for a Roomba.
I don't have one of those either.
Yeah, well, there you go. So, we look at this, and it's one of the societal things, so we don't talk about it much on the air because it's a dead serious topic, but we are getting to the point where all the economic systems of the world are failing because all of them, I don't care what it is, are based upon full employment. And we no longer need that. And as time goes on, we'll need that less and less. And not everybody is an entrepreneur. And so what will happen? Well, again, that's for brighter minds than me. But it absolutely is a problem.
I wonder what jobs will be left that they can't do. There's
probably many things. Because as I say, they're pretty far away from inductive reasoning. So, all of the things that the Industrial Revolution bought us, all of the assembly lines and stuff like that, that's already a foregone conclusion. And there will be a lot more as well. So, and we're starting to see the amount of people who are not needed in specific jobs. And, you know, I mean, what's the answer? I don't know. They float guaranteed income for all. But this is one where whoever comes up with this really gets the Nobel Prize because it is a problem. And on that note, just have fun with Bandit, who is very much alive and not robotic at all.
No, he's not.
All right.
He's a good boy.
That's right. That's right. And you're spoiling him to death. And that's just...
I am.
Yeah.
I am.
And that's just wonderful. Well, keep me posted, and thanks for calling.
Okay. Thanks, right. Riley. Bye.
Yeah. So while we're back to technology for a minute, not high tech, but wonderful tech, the Sea Crane Company. Oh, man, I'll tell you what. Bob Crane should be knighted. When he, like many of us, were complaining about radio reception decades ago, he said, I can do better. And he did. All of his radios have terrific AM and FM reception, unbeatable AM and FM reception for modern radios. And many of them have a ton of other lovely features that you will like. But when I say that the Wi-Fi 3 has unbeatable reception, you're thinking, well, it's not AM or FM. What is it? It will connect to even the most lackluster wireless access point or Wi-Fi router. So if you have one where, you know, you got some form of Wi-Fi radio and it's always buffering or dropping the signal and all that, man, the CC Wi-Fi 3 will fix that. Not only that, it is absolutely easy to use. No apps to download, no monthly fees, no ads on the screen, no microphones listening to you, and best of all, easy to use. There are literally tens of thousands of radio stations. It might be 100,000, and podcasts and other streams and things like that. And as I say, thank God they didn't have this in 1957, or I never would have left the bedroom. But they have it now, and there's no reason that you can't listen, for instance, to WGN with full clarity. Maybe it's a night where there's thunder and all sorts of interference. Well, no static, no fading online. So if you've got a decent broadband connection, whatever it is, The CC Wi-Fi 3 is the hot ticket from the Sea Crane Company. It comes with a full-size remote control and will pick up a strong Wi-Fi signal even when it's farther away from your home router than you would otherwise expect. Go to ccradio.com, ccradio.com. Look at the CC Wi-Fi 3. Now, if you have questions, or if you're ordering this for somebody else and you're not online, well, either way, call them. They've got great customer service, 800-522-8863, 800-522-TUNE. But if you can go online, this is such a great catalog. And by the way, they'll send you a hard copy of the catalog when you order anything, or if you just want one, they'll send you one for free. But if you go online, you'll not only see great products, but great information about radio, too. So go to ccradio.com, look at the CC Wi-Fi 3, you tell them Raleigh sent you from WGN Radio.
When I met a little girl about a week ago, and I felt that I ought to let her know. But since then my heart had broke a string and go.
Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong.
Go ding dong, ding. When I'm little, it goes ding dong, ding. When I'm little, it goes ding dong, ding. Cause I want to be go ding dong, ding dong. You know I love you, lovely little girl. And if you kiss me, it would give me the world. All around my heart, where the feeling is, it goes
ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong.
My heart goes ding dong, ding. When I'm near you, it goes ding dong, ding. When I want you, it goes ding dong, ding. Cause I need you, it goes ding dong, ding dong.
Six packs, and that's the G Clefs. Yeah, you thought Doo Wop didn't come out of Boston? Well, probably didn't, but it did out of Roxbury, that's for sure, and that's where they were from. There were four brothers, actually, who formed that group. The Scott brothers, Teddy, Chris, Timmy, and Arnold. I think their next door neighbor was in the act, too, Ray Gibson. And there might have been other people briefly, but that pretty much was it for the G Clefs. And that was actually the first single they released, 1956, on Pilgrim. And the flip side, Darla, My Darlin', was also worthy of airplay. So thanks to Jimmy P for suggesting it. Yeah, I was thinking a little more about these robots that that we are seeing now everywhere. And keep in mind that it's not only a question of the technology developing to a point; it's also about how much does it cost to get one. You know, I was joking about how much it costs to get one to clean your house, but for instance, you've got easy aisle scanners for inventory, but getting something that's going to be able to handle the bagging and know that the eggs are fragile and what to do with the fruit and all those things, it actually does exist, but there's no grocery store on the planet that can afford to have them. So that's a factor as well. Eventually the R&D comes out of it, but for now, I think that you're pretty safe on that. So back to low tech. Did you know there's 8 colors you didn't know existed? Actually, on a spiritual plane, there's probably tens of thousands of colors you didn't know existed, but I mean on this particular planet. And, you thought that Crayola covered them all and they're, 500 box or whatever. The average English speaker identifies 11 colors in general. That's interesting. I guess there's been surveys. And objects fall into one color category or another, or it's amalgamation of two, like blue, green, or red, orange, or whatever. And that's easy. But apparently, we've got other colors. And of course, they're amalgamations. But Drake's neck, it's apparently, if you spend time watching ducks in the park, you'll recognize it. It's a rich bottle green color, and it refers to a male mallard, the drake, And apparently that was actually replicated as a dye in the 18th century. Drunk Tank Pink, and that's been used to reduce hostile, violent, and aggressive behavior, making it the perfect color to paint holding cells. And notoriously, the former sheriff of Maricopa County would use them for prisoner underwear. But the official name of the color is Baker Miller Pink. And the directors at the Naval Correctional Facility, where they researched this, found out that this might actually work. It's also known as Pepto-Bismol Pink or Barbie Pink, but there it is. All right. I don't even know how to pronounce it. Eburbnian. Instead of painting the walls ivory, off-white, eggshell, pearl, or beige, try Eburbnian, yellowish-white, Latin. You, yeah, right. It's translate to made of or relating to ivory. There are other odd color names for ivory. I know. I'm trying to think of one. I was working somewhere and we had a personal appearance, and on the memo, it told us to wear this. I forget the color now, but absolutely none of us knew what it was. Not a clue. But falu, a shade of dye often used in deep red paint, and yes, the quintessential red barn door. And why falu? It was found in the mines of fallen Sweden. Gamboge, that covers a range of colors of yellow, deep saffron to mustard yellow. And the easiest reference, they say, is the robes of Buddhist monks, but I personally haven't seen any. It's a natural dye sourced from the gum resin of Southeast Asian trees. All right, here you go. This is terrible. I even wondered whether I could mention this on the air. Goose turd green. A real color name coined during the Elizabethan era. Like Drake's neck, it was avian inspired, but it's a deeper reflection of the bird's anatomy. We probably don't need to go further than say it's a bright light green color specifically used in fashion and a part of sensational marketing tactics to attract customers. Yeah, if they knew what it was called, maybe they wouldn't be likely to. Along the same disgusting lines, there's puke. And that's actually considered to be, as of the 16th century, a color, puke-colored, green, yellow, any combination. Well, no. Actually, it was originally, in the 16th century, high-quality wool used to make stockings that they called puke, from the Dutch word puke, P-U-U-C, meaning best grade of cloth. So it was a deep brown dye used for hosiery. So, yeah, puke-colored. Razzmatazz? Sure, why not? Between raspberries and roses, invented in 1993 by Crayola, but they're inventive guys there. First introduced in the big box, it actually wasn't that big, only 96 crayons, but one of them was razzmatazz. It was named by a five-year-old in a contest. Name the new color contest. Yeah. See, I was waiting for things like statutory grape, but so far they're not in any of the boxes. Anti-established mint. Yeah, there's all sorts of possibilities, but those are official as far as that goes, in case you were wondering. 888-876-5593. Fran is in Austin. What's up tonight, Fran?
I'm still laughing at your two colors that you came up with.
Oh yeah, years ago I came up with
establishment. I like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was the '60s I had suggested it, and it was funny because many years later on Rush's show, he actually referred to something. I don't know, some politician was behaving badly, and he thought it was hilarious that someone thought a statutory grape. And I thought, hey, Rush, I thought of this about 40 years ago. So, yeah.
Yeah, I know. I've done that. I thought of words or something, and then somebody else says, what? That was mine.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, one thing is I finally got my computer sort of working.
Yeah.
The reason I say sort of working is because I hate Windows 11. Nothing seems to work the way, so many other keystrokes are different.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to do my email, and I've got a whole bunch of it I want to delete. And it's just, it deletes one, and then it stops while it opens the other. I don't want it to open them. I just want to go through the list and delete them.
Right.
Absolutely. And, because I've got like 1,200 and something in that. And I usually use my other email address because that one is so clogged up.
Yeah.
And it's mostly junk. And so I want to get rid of it. The only good thing is that I can listen to a lot of the music I have on my computer,
okay,
which is great. You know, so that's a good thing. But, oh, my God.
You're not alone.
Learn, and I've got, yeah, I know. I've got three hours left of tech training. And I don't think I'm going to get too far with that because I'm going between the, I want to learn to do some other things on my phone as well. And so I have to divide this training between those two things. But at least it's progress. At least, you know, my computer is working again. The only problem is poor Gary's computer totally died.
Oh, geez. How old is the computer? How old is the computer?
How old is your computer, Gary? How old is your computer? About 9 years old.
And he's running Windows 11 on it?
No, he's running Windows 10.
All right, I was going to say Windows 10. It will accept, and of course, if it's dying, you can't really ask it why it died.
Yeah, no, it won't come up. I mean,
right? That's what I mean.
Tried,
so
you know,
it's a brick.
Yeah, we put it in other plugs. We but other things work in that outlet. So it's not an outlet problem.
No, it's a brick at this point. That one's going to be tough.
Yeah.
There's actually, like, for things about how to quickly delete email and stuff, believe it or not, if you go to Google and you just say Windows 11, how do I quickly delete email, and mention the email program, whatever it is, you'd be surprised. This is something where AI is pretty damn good at it, and it may give you a quick answer.
Oh, okay.
And,
I'll try that.
Yeah,
I say,
it's not perfect by any means, and I've been led down the garden path a few times, but for the most part, I've been impressed about how good it is with current technology. Now, of course, the definition of insanity when it comes to Windows and Microsoft is doing the same thing the same way and expecting the same result, because you won't get it. It will be different each time. And the problem with Windows 11 is that the brain trust in Redmond, Washington, apparently, looks at things that are absolutely glitches in the programming and decides whether it's integral to the program or whether it's just something that's a convenience for the user. Case in point, if you are accessing files elsewhere on your LAN, and you've set them up on the computer, say, as music files, and you're accessing them from another computer, they come up as general items, period. And you can change them to music sometimes, but they won't stay. Now, I am so not alone in this. There are tens of thousands of people complaining about this. And Microsoft just says, well, that's not integral to the program, so we haven't put it on the docket to fix.
Of course.
Well, it's integral to my life, people. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But so, try the AI thing. I think you will be surprised.
Yeah, I will. I use ChatGPT on my phone a lot, and it tells me stuff, but, you know, pretty good. But sometimes it is mistaken. But I want, talking about robots to clean my house, I don't, you know, I wouldn't mind having a robot to clean my house, but I also want it to cook.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
Oh God, that would. I hate to cook. I can, you know, I don't mind. I mean, I don't like to clean the house, but I don't mind it. But I absolutely loathe cooking.
I don't blame you.
Well, you know,
it takes so much time, and the payoff, you eat the meal in 20 minutes. So it's like you spent.
And then you got to clean up, and then you got, you know, it's like,
right.
I always want to cook things that you just pour some, you know, you get some meat, you pour some sauce over it, and that's it.
Right.
You know, or whatever.
Right. Right, the old just add water. Yes, exactly. I'm with you. It's a total waste of time. And I know there are cooks who enjoy this and all, and I look at it and say, that's 3 hours out of my day for your damn meal, you know, so that's
yeah.
Yeah. I know.
I've got a friend who's vegan, and she also keeps kosher. And I said, what in the heck do you eat? But she spends so much time in the kitchen, you know, with doing things. And I'm like, oh, my God, no, I give up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I ate too many of those frozen dinners and things. And I know that's not good for me, but.
Well, it's quick,
cooking,
it's easy, and sometimes it's tasty. No, I understand that. And, of course, you microwave them, and God knows what that does to the nutrition count. I'm convinced it's doing us no good whatsoever.
Oh, that's probably very true, you know, but it's easy. I go
that's
for easy.
Exactly right. I'm with you 100%. But, of course, this probably explains why I'm not a well woman, you know, so I'm sure that sure that eating correctly would be a big boon to health, but then I couldn't do anything else. I'd just be cooking.
Right. Yeah, and a lot of times you say you eat like a 9-year-old whose parents are gone
for
the weekend. I can relate. I can definitely relate to that. It was funny because I went to the doctor. My A1C was down. I'm not even on any kind of diabetic medication now.
Good, good.
It's, you know, but it, and she said, you must be really doing well on your diet. I just kind of smiled.
Yeah.
I didn't really say anything because
right.
I have not been doing well. That morning, I had just had 2 donuts. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. No, it you know, a lot of that, it's just the way it is. Your pancreas decided to work for a couple weeks, so yeah.
Right, yeah. So now if everything else would work right, they've had to increase my methotrexate because I'm having pain again.
Oh.
So they'd cut it down, but now I'm having pain in my knees and hands again. So I had to bite the bullet and call her and say, do I need to, not that I want to do this, but do I need to increase my methotrexate? And she said yes, and I'm not happy about that, but, you know, it's
well,
not the end of the world.
No, you're going to monitor it closely. First, you'll monitor it to see if it makes a big difference, because if it doesn't make a big difference, then the side effects aren't worth it. But if it does make a big difference, then the key is just to really monitor your body, and when you see certain side effects, being proactive immediately.
Yeah, she doesn't really seem to listen when I talk about some of the side effects, you know, like the fuzzy, the chemo brain thing and all.
Yeah,
that.
And it's absolutely.
Oh, well, you're not on a high enough dose and,
I disagree with that. But the fuzzy brain's bad enough, but it's when you start getting the rashes that you were talking about and all that, that's when you really want somebody to look at that.
Yeah, and she says, "Oh, it's a little red." Yeah, she gave me some cream for it.
Yeah, right.
And then of course I went to the eye doctor because I've been having an infection in my eyes. And wouldn't you know, that particular day, it wasn't bothering me.
Oh God.
Yeah, and so she says, "Well, your eyes look fine." And I said, "Yeah, but this is just today. Yesterday, you should have seen them." But you know.
Well, the good news on that, at least, is it hasn't gotten to the point where it's making a difference in terms of truly physically. It's annoying and all that, but if they're looking at your eyes and saying everything's solid, then you're not having damage. But nonetheless, it's a pain. And of course, like with the rash or whatever, half the time they give you a cortisone cream, which, you know, it just kind of adds up to the problem anyway. So,
Yeah, that's what they gave me, this big old tub of cortisone
cream.
Yep,
that's, I know. Yeah. I know the drill. I wish I didn't.
And then they gave me something that I could actually put in my eye, but it does not seem to be. I can only use it for a week on, a week off. I'm still kicking, and I'm not, you know, I just have to deal with this stuff and go forward. But,
yeah, it's absolutely absolutely annoying. It's not not acute, not life threatening, but it's chronic as hell, and it's a major inconvenience. So I understand completely.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. No. It's like how can I be irritated? Let me count the ways. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So
yeah. I get
one
it.
One thing is another. I pray if I like, okay, I just want one day where I feel good.
Let me know when that happens.
I will. Believe me, you'll hear me from here going, yay!
All right.
Good. But sometimes, yeah, okay, well, I'll let you go.
Thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
All right.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bye.
Yeah. My frustration today, I was working in the storage Connex box in the backyard. And this by the way, is the deluxe storage Connex box. So don't think that it isn't well provisioned. It's very well air conditioned, and it's got nice carpeting and good drywall and everything else. So you'd never, you know, when you're inside it, it's 40 feet long and 10 feet wide. You wouldn't know that it was, you know, a railroad car, but it's perfect for the task. But why I bring that up is, you know, I don't do well with creepy crawly things. Highly allergic to mosquitoes, for instance. So I go in there. I don't care that it's 112 degrees today. Doesn't matter to me. I am clothed head to foot. I'm wearing a long sleeve sweatshirt. I'm wearing sweatpants tight to the body so nothing can get up the side of it. What I didn't realize, more shoes, of course, I didn't realize the socks were the weak link. I'm not exactly sure what bites me, but both of my ankles, multiple bites. It's like, what the hell is this? So John took a picture of them and said, why don't you ask AI? I thought, no, AI does good with my computer problems. I won't be asking at that. But, you know, maybe I'll get to the point that that's a good idea. In the meantime, playing another one of your requests is a good idea. I think we've got Stans from Dearborn coming up on WGN Radio. Shepherds. They were just so great. And that was 1961. It was also 62 on VJ, but originally 61 on Apex, which was Monkey Shepherd's label. And I just thought it was a wonderful song. And of course, the flip side on Apex was Feel Like Lovin', that is also a wonderful song. And but they did so many good things as far as that goes. Elevator Operator, just love it. And more. So anyway, that was one of Jimmy P. Sixpack. 888-876-5593. Glenn is in Madison. Welcome back to WGN Radio.
Hi, Raleigh. Thanks for the welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, do you have Turn It Up, American Radio Tales, Bob Shannon's book?
I do not.
All right. This is actually a compendium. Some of them were columns years ago in R&R, but it is just a great little book, and it's got 58 different profiles of everybody from, you know, basically your Wolfman Jackson, Gary Owens and all that, to Lee Abrams and everybody in between.
Don Barrett, I think, did something similar
well,
in L.A.
Yes, but this is much more involved. Very well aware of that. But
okay.
So, yeah, if you can get a copy of it, Turn It Up, American Radio Tales. And Bob Shannon is actually John Driscoll, but it was who's voiceover guy.
The John Driscoll,
yes.
Who did mornings at 10Q?
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely true.
So I want to digress.
Yeah.
when 10Q came on the air for the first time, when KGBS stopped being a daytimer,
right?
They changed the pattern, and they were supposed to play something, and I guess it went amiss. And then there was profanity on the air.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it was amazing to me in 75 that would happen.
Yeah, and what's interesting is probably nobody heard it. But
probably not, because it was like someone who was off mic. The only reason I heard it is I think I had recorded it.
Yeah, and that's probably very true. And, of course, the real benefactor of that full-time signal was also creating Roswell, New Mexico, as far as that 1020. That Storer paid for it.
Ah, okay. I had not realized that connection.
Yep. So.
So I tried the Don Sherwood book, and I realized my problem with it is I had no idea of who he was, and so he didn't. There was no sort of emotional connection. It was just like writing.
Oh, okay. He was. You know, I'm a big sucker for the MOR morning men of the 50s and early 60s. I just thought they were the hippest guys in the room. And I thought it was so funny because, of course, because of the music, people who were top 40 fans never really viewed it as hip, but they were just terrific. And Don Sherwood was a San Francisco guy. In fact, the world's greatest disc jockey. And he hosted mornings on KSFO in San Francisco when Gene Autry had it. He was born and raised in San Francisco, but he was great. He made fun of all the commercials. He had a lot of sound effects and imitated singers and had a number of comic features, just plain Rosita, and where he pretended to translate the story of a Spanish language soap opera, which actually was a dialogue from a Spanish language instructional record, but nonetheless. He was just clever as hell. And what it was, my all-time favorite morning man was Dan Sorkin from WCFL. And Dan's the one who came up with Save Rose Bimler. You know about that, right?
Yes. Okay. And I think you said you tried reading his book and it was too far out for you.
Yeah, the blabbermouths. Don't bother. But
okay.
when Don was looking for partners in crime, the first one he turned to was Don Sherwood. So Don picked up the mantle of Save Rose Bimler. And, you know, that's when, of course, Real Don Steele heard the bit and, you know, came up with Tina Delgado and same colors on the button and everything.
Oh, I did not realize there was a connection between
the
two.
There's a connection. Yeah, nobody else knows it, but it is true. And if you look at the Tina Delgado buttons, that kind of yellowish color with, well, you can't, I know. But for people who can, it's kind of a yellowish button. It's got red letters, and it's the exact same colors of Save Rose Bimler. Because I still have my Save Rose buttons, of course. And anyway, but he was, hated rock and roll, but how he'd make fun of it was just classic. And, like I say, I'm surprised he had sponsors because he would just absolutely tamper with them. So in Berkeley Farms was a dairy product in the Bay Area. And, you know, he'd have cows mooing and, you know, farms in Berkeley and all this. And he had Mel Blanc do a cow voice. And it was just classic and, you know, something unrelated to the commercial, obviously. But clever as hell. And he had a late night show on KGO-TV briefly. But it was the KSFO thing that just made it special. But yeah, if you if you didn't hear them, and I'm wondering, I'm going to look at YouTube. Are there any Don Sherwood air checks? I don't know. Let's see.
Yeah, I don't either. I think I actually looked on Real Radio, but maybe not, knowing it wasn't his genre. But
right.
Still.
This is 54 minutes of KSFO San Francisco, Don Sherwood, March 3rd, 1961.
I will look.
There's also on YouTube a blooper reel of Don Sherwood with Jack Carney. And then there's a tribute to Don Sherwood on there, which is fairly short. And you can hear that, the Berkeley Farms thing I talked about, you can hear it. It's on there. And there are others as well. So yeah, it'll absolutely help to know who he is to get him. You know, because it's the same thing. The one who we've talked about him before, the guy who came from Pittsburgh to L.A. and just bombed after Bob Crane.
Not Reege Kordick.
Absolutely, Reege Kordick. And Reege Kordick was so good in Pittsburgh. I mean, this was must-listened radio. And he just died in L.A., and which was sad. But it was fine for him because he wound up with a really good voiceover career. But man, when he was on in Pittsburgh, wonderful stuff. Yeah, that beer he'd sell with the foam at the bottom and all that kind of stuff. It was just classic radio.
Well, I was actually calling about YouTube because my friend Claude and I, the AI tool, got me past my big block with posting my old KMPC interviews there.
Yeah.
And the block was curating a reasonable a picture of the person I had interviewed.
Okay.
And generating it in a way that was visually acceptable and generating the video and uploading it. And so I have a series of scripts that'll do that now. And so I started posting these interviews, youtube.com/@Glenn Gordon.
Okay.
And that's the good part. The bad part is it's really hard to attract an audience.
Oh, insane.
Because they're old.
Well, yeah.
They're old.
There's a bigger
problem. Herman.
A bigger problem than that, actually, before we even get to the content and what might or might be wrong with it, is the fact that no one has ever searched for something they don't know exists. And so.
Yes, exactly.
It wouldn't matter even if it was something everybody wanted to hear. If they didn't know it was there, that would do it. So.
But sometimes the algorithms point you there.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's true. And if you're listening to one thing, you get something from another. And so I'm at YouTube now, and I'm gonna go to @Glenn Gordon. Okay, and vintage radio interviews. All right, what I'm gonna do is I'm going to give it a link on Raleigh.net.
Oh, thank you very much.
Oh, sure, happy to do it. Because there are many people who want to hear K-Star. My favorite K-Star actually is her version of I've Got the World on a String. So, not really sure why. But yeah, look at this. Artie Shaw. Oh, how was he as an interview?
He was phenomenal. It's probably the best interview I ever did.
Wow. Well, it probably is the best one he did because he was such a cantankerous guy. I can't wait to hear this.
So I think the reason it turned out so well is I had read about him in Joe Smith's book, Off the Record.
Right.
And Joe's comment basically was, he was completely antagonistic to fans, and the interview started at 1 in the afternoon. I left at 3. It may still be going on. And so when I had the opportunity to interview him, because they had released some CDs with previously unreleased material, I thought about how do I want to put, the questions together, and it really was, what makes him tick? If he was rude to his fans, was that a personality failure, or is it something about him that everybody was missing?
Well, that's great.
And so I think because I did it that way, I got a very interesting answers, and he was amazingly candid.
Yeah, I'm not surprised about that at all. Absolutely. But I'm going to listen to that. That's great. I love the way he claimed that, like, Frenesy paid for 3 of his divorces.
Oh, he said that on the interview.
Yeah.
Yes.
One of his famous lines, yes. And Andrew and Phil Harris. Oh, I loved Phil Harris.
Phil Harris. The amazing part about these interviews at that point in time was it was KMPC, and the contemporaries of these people
listened.
Would call in.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
And they talked to them.
Yeah.
Phil Harris was really touched.
I just loved him. And that's what I like about the South. Yeah. So, that's great. George Fenneman, this is great. Freddie Cannon, that's timely. See, that should...
That was not KMPC. That was 78. Okay. That was the one Play It Again, Glenn interview I did. And, yeah. So, funny story, and maybe you can offer some insight. So, when I interviewed Sid Mark...
Uh-huh.
He said there was a jazz DJ in L.A. named Sleepy Stein.
Yep.
And I, at the time, you know, my 30-year-old self said, oh, you know, you mean Saul Levine.
No.
Because Saul Levine, of course, had, you know, KBCA/KKGO.
No, it wasn't.
It was not. It was Sleepy Stein. Right. I just didn't know who Sleepy Stein was.
He put KNOB on the air.
Yes. I knew KNOB when it was Beautiful Music, right. And then I don't know what it was after that.
And, you know, they when he bought it, he'd do things from the Lighthouse Cafe in Hermosa Beach and things like that. K-Fox did, too. But I think that KNOB had originally been licensed to Signal Hill. So I don't know. Alan Schultz and Chuck Niles and Jim Gosa, they were all there. Yeah.
And then they all went, and then they all did go to Saul Levine.
Right. Well, sure. Sure. Right? KKGO, of course. Absolutely. But interestingly, KNOB was financed in part by Stan Kenton.
I have no idea.
Yeah. But Sleepy Stein was not young. As you'd expect. I think he was, you know, born before 1920. So he wouldn't have really been a contemporary to anything we normally would like. But he was around for quite a while. And as far as that goes. And he was originally from Savannah, I think. And he was alive until at least 2000. I think he died in Palos Verdes or something. But anyway.
Really?
Yeah.
It must be something who... Something about people who own jazz radio stations in Los Angeles.
Yeah, right.
Because Saul Levine is like 101 now.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely amazing as far as that. But Sleepy Stein went to the University of Havana, and he lived in Miami for a while, too. And then he got the name in Chicago, I think, because he replaced a disc jockey whose handle was Wide Awake, so he was Sleepy Stein. And we went to Phoenix briefly, and then he was, you know, at K-Fox, like I say, in Long Beach, but who wasn't? And that was mostly the Hermosa Beach stuff. And then he bought KNOB in about 57, and that's when it went all jazz, the Jazz Knob. And, and he was doing something from a Long Beach nightclub, Strollers. And so, but he had a day job. He was a stockbroker.
Yeah, I had read that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know what happened. His collection got willed to something, so it's somewhere.
What will happen? Speaking of collections, what will happen to your collection? Not that I'm trying to kill you off.
Who cares? Put it in the dumpster. I don't care. Someone asked me that recently. I just doesn't matter to me.
Truly?
Yeah, truly. I mean, who the heck wants this stuff? Because almost everybody who would be interested in it or who remembers it is dead.
Or approaching your age.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, spending the time for somebody like that to, you know, archive it and put it together and all that, it may be a labor of love, but it's very short-lived, to say the least. You know, most of this stuff will die with us.
So I only want to say, if I sound half as good at your age, which I have inferred, by the way, but we'll leave it between us.
Okay.
If I sound half as good at your age, I will be thrilled. You're just amazing on the air.
Oh, you're
and
so
it's,
nice.
It's great listening to you. And thank you for letting me do shameless self-promotion.
Absolutely. Now, here's another book. Jack Gale, Same Time, Same Station. You will like that.
You know, so the only reason I know of Jack Gale is when he was so out of his element. I guess he was friendly with the manager slash program director at K100. And he did Weekend.
No. George Wilson, who I loved, I miss him. But he and George worked together at WITH in Baltimore and in other places as well.
But I thought that's why he was on K100.
Oh, absolutely. Bill Taylor was too, and Bill Taylor also worked at WITH. So, in fact, Bill was at K100 when he called me, and he said, "I'm too old to be a rock and roll disc jockey. I'm going to put a radio station on the air." And after he lost several frequencies because of the EEO rules, where people used his engineering to apply for the frequencies and get them, he called me. He was just so mad.
Yeah.
I need help, and I said, "Sure, use my name." No. That's unethical. I need your help. I want to find the worst place on earth so that no one will file on me. It's got to be within 90 miles of a major city because I got health problems, and it's got to be, and he had a whole list of things. And so that's why I'm in Globe, because when he was dying, I was in Chattanooga, perfectly happy, in the gig city, I might add, and he called. He said, "Remember the worst place on earth?" I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "You're about to own two radio stations, and I'm dying. Get here." And that's how I got to Globe. But he absolutely was on K100.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you may not want to answer this question, but what percentage of your revenue comes from renting tower space versus the radio stations?
Different corporations, firstly, not owned together. But I would say that the number one income provider is tower space for the cell companies by far.
Next
time you call, we can talk about local radio and all that. But no, if I had to live off the local radio revenue, I'd be very hungry.
But yet you still do it.
Well, there's a reason. So call me and next time and I'll tell you. There's a big reason.
Sounds good.
Okay, good. Thanks, Glenn. I appreciate it.
Thanks for your time.
Okay.
Bye.
And I will, of course, look for more books, and we will do this. And then after the news, well, we're already doing it. So that's good to know. We'll talk to you after the news on WGN Radio. James, Chicago all the way, 29th Street and State, and the Calvaes, C-A-L-V-A-E-S, and no, I don't know how they got their name. They wound up, Zeke Brown, by the way, was the lead singer, that's the only member I know, but they were on Cobra. And Cobra was Eli Toscano's label, and actually I think he folded it shortly after that record, but nonetheless, he released about four records by them. But I was trying to remember whether this was 56 or 57, because obviously they don't print dates on the records anymore. And so, this is just great. I got to find it here, because I saved it. It was almost too good to be true. All right, so I go ahead and use my little, Google AI, don't you know, write Calvaes, C-A-L-V-A-E-S, and write Born With Rhythm. And the answer I got was, newborn calves do not possess a fully synchronized or stable internal circadian rhythm at birth. And so, of course, I complained. I can't, of course, you know I complained. Yeah, no, Calvace, they're a singing group. And actually, I got born with rhythm and released on August 26, 1957. So I got my answer, but not after strolling down the aisle with cows. All right, so we got Lisa, and Lisa is in Joliet. So, Lisa, thank you, thank you, thank you for the goodie pack.
Oh, good. You know, I was so pleased that you received it because, you know, sometimes there are issues with the mail. So I'm glad it worked out and you enjoyed it.
Oh, and I do. I've got it right here. And I mentioned it on Monday night. As soon as I saw Dino, I thought, you know, I've got one from American before they were Amoco. And I thought, ah, let me put a battery in this and put it right next to it. It's just perfect.
Does it work?
Yeah.
Good, yeah. Good. You know, Rally, I have a small transistor collection. Uh-huh. And I'm a collector. I have beautiful displays. I have a room that's devoted to my collectibles.
Uh-huh.
They're all in cases. Uh-huh. I am a fuss budget. I'm currently, as I'm listening to you, I dismantled a 1968 Mustang fastback model.
Oh, okay.
I'm cleaning it. Picked it up today from an insurance agent who has a makeshift antique shop in his office. I saw the sign and I went in and I saw this Mustang model. I dated a guy in high school who had one.
Uh-huh.
So I decided for $5, why not? It was pretty dirty, so I dismantled it. And now I'm trying to figure out how to mount the engine.
Well, actually, the 68 is interesting. One of the things on it, and I'm sure it's got this, is that was the year they introduced those side marker lights. So you have to put those on.
Yes.
Yes, right. And of course, it was famous because of the movie Bullet. So
yes, yes. Steve McQueen.
Yeah. So, yep. So that,
and
it was,
go ahead, I'm
it
listening.
Was interesting. If you had it as a Cobra jet, that had a really nice engine. It was a 428 cubic inch, but the base V8 was like a 289 and a 302. It wasn't, you know, it was V8, but it really wasn't a power car.
Yeah. Yeah. I, you know, it's funny because I have a nephew, he's 21 and he's a gearhead, and he has a Mustang that he has in pieces now. He's working on it. Well, he took me for a ride in it last year, and he opened it up, and I thought I was going to get whiplash.
Oh, good.
But I enjoy, you know, I'll pick up toys from the 60s, and I'll, you know, they'll be in really bad shape, and I'll just disassemble them. I'll clean them up. I have a 67 Schwinn Fair Lady that I picked up for $60 at a garage sale last summer. I'm gonna send you pictures of it by before and after.
Yeah,
and it's a beauty. I actually had a guy over on Friday. He bought a bicycle from me, and he saw that fair lady. He was salivating.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's got that banana seat and the high rise handlebars.
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
and I always wanted a girl's muscle bike,
uh-huh,
but I'd always get a Columbia. Get a Columbia, the mixty step through, the, you know, very conservative, and man, I wanted a Stingray.
Yeah, of course. Of course, absolutely.
So now I have one, but my best friend I grew up with, she had the same fair lady, and she wanted it. She didn't want to pay $60 for it at the time, but when she saw after I restored it,
oh, wow,
then she wanted to buy it from me for $60.
No,
said,
no,
no,
no, no, no.
It went way up the value.
Yeah, I think they'd be about $450 is about fair.
Yes, you got it.
Yeah.
Yes, so I... This is my one of my retirement passions.
Oh, that's great.
You know, I'm into collecting, and like I said, I'll send you some photos of my collectibles, and just look for you. Look in your email. I'll send you a few photos.
Oh, great! I'd love to see it. And yeah, there are so many products in the '60s that were interesting, like those Boy Watcher sunglasses that came out, and all those other things that were just bizarre.
Oh yeah, I just love it. I love going to the estate sales, and I love going to the antique shops, and it's fun, and I am full throng into it. So
that's great.
But distinction between hoarding and collecting, for sure.
Well, actually, the fact that you organize it and you keep it clean, and then it's not hoarding.
Yeah.
It's only hoarding when you fall over it to get inside the house.
Thank you. And when you, you know, when you have to dig a path to get through.
Right. Then you've got a problem. But other than that, no, if you want to collect things, I think it's great.
Yeah. Yes. I'll send you some photos over the weekend.
Okay.
And I just tell you really quick, Bruno tried to elope the other night.
What?
He ended up at animal control. I had to bail him out yesterday.
Oh no.
I had to go, well, my neighbor called animal control.
Oh.
Because he didn't know how to handle the situation, but it all worked out.
Well, now you tried to elope. So with that in mind, what is the target of his affection?
Another chihuahua by the name of Styx.
Oh, and how sexy.
He knows where to come back, and I don't allow my dogs to roam, of course, but the little stinker, he darted out on me, and he took off, and I knew he was going to come back, but my neighbor didn't know what to do. I was in and out trying to look for him, and he picked him up, brought him into his place, and called animal control.
Oh, jeez.
But the neighbor paid the fines.
Really?
He said, I'm sorry this happened. But, yeah, I had to go bail him out yesterday.
Wow. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
But anyway, it all worked out. But I'll get you some photos. And I'm working on another mini care package for you because I found some goodies today.
That's so
kind
of
you. I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag, but found a couple of goodies.
Well, you know, you're putting me to shame because it's been 3 years since I've mailed out a darn prize, and here you are mailing me stuff, so I'm putting me to shame.
I love it. I found Silvertone.
Oh, yeah.
My brother's a musician. He lives in Florida.
Uh-huh.
And he's a building inspector by day, but he's into music. And I found a Silvertone for $75, cleaned it up. I took it to the guitar shop. They gave me a coffin case for it. I shipped it to him. He's back in his music, and he also purchased a Gretsch. So it's a Sears Silvertone. I researched it. It was like a 68 or a 69.
Okay.
Electric. So anyway, I'll let you go. You're a busy lady. You're a popular lady. But I just wanted to say hi and thank you for playing my request.
Oh, absolutely. I'm so glad you called, and thank you. It was a great goodie package, and hope to hear from you soon.
Okay, take care.
Okay, bye. Yeah, Silvertone was a house brand for Sears going back to like 1916, and they actually would sell tubes and things like that, and of course everything else, the musical instruments and the receivers and all that. But like all the Sears stuff, they didn't make it, obviously. Dan Electro made some stuff on the guitars as far as that goes, but I've never really looked like that Twin 12, that guitar amp. I don't know who actually made that. But yeah, it was great. They later, of course, like everything else, sold the name. Some South Korean company bought it. And yeah, so it's not the same. Gee, no kidding. All right, so we'll get to Brian and Seneca. There's room for you too. 888-876-5593 on WGN Radio. That's the Valentine's. Richie Barrett wrote it and sings lead. But that great bass, that's Ronnie Bright. And that was one of Jimmy P's six packs. I think we got one left to play. So that is the deal there. Now, 888-876-5593 takes us to Brian and Seneca. What's up tonight, Brian?
Oh, even more than what I thought when I first I called you, try to knock him out in order and see if we can get fitted in before the news. I can stick around if we can't. First off, your caller, Glenn Gordon.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a must-listen-to radio moment. I found his site on YouTube, and I have subscribed to it. I'm
good.
Later tonight, before I go to sleep, I'm going to listen to the George Fenneman interview. He was, of course, Groucho Marx's announcer, and also, at least in the 1950s, the voice of Dragnet.
Yes.
He might have also been the voice of Dragnet in the 1960s,
I don't know.
I have to listen to him back to back, but he was definitely the voice of Dragnet in the 50s, and can't wait to listen to that.
Good.
Okay, next off, your comment on car paints. Anti-establishment.
Yeah.
Was actually a real color used by the Ford Motor Company between 1969 and 1972 on multiple models, including the Ford Maverick,
really?
Ford Mustang, and Ford Pinto. Yes, Ford had a pun naming campaign, and so did the Chrysler Corporation, and anti-establishment was one of Ford's.
Wow, and what year was this?
1969 to 1972.
Well, hell, I was saying it before 69. Interesting.
Yes. And at this point, I would have otherwise made up a joke about Pininfarina building a custom purple sports car for Roman Polanski.
That would work.
But I don't have to, because Statutory Grape was an in-house color name for the color that they released in 1970, as Plum Crazy on Dodge and Inviolet on Plymouth.
That's great. You know what?
The internal name, of course, is Statutory Grape, and it was a little bit too risque in 1970.
Yeah. It fits. I would think anti-establishment would have been really good for some of those Challengers, too. So, yeah, I could see that purple color and that green color, both Chrysler products. You betcha.
Yes, and in honor of Statutory Grape, I wanted to request Jerry Lee Lewis, Crazy Arms.
Okay.
Now, the request is because it is Jerry Lee Lewis, but I requested Crazy Arms because it's a good song, and it's also one that has never been played into the ground, unlike all of his later hits, both Sun Rock and later country rockabilly, because Jerry Lee Lewis had staying power, and it was him and his old piano and all that, and he outlived Elvis, and just like Elvis, performed pretty much until he died. So
yeah, it's interesting.
More music, more,
that record goes back to the 40s.
Crazy Arms as Jerry Lee, that's his first Sun recording.
It was. It was in 56, but Mooney and Seals wrote it in 49. And Ray Price had a hit with it in 56, before the December 56 recording by Jerry Lee. So Ray Price, for country fans, would be the version people remember.
Okay.
But I will be happy to do that. But yeah, the Ray Price one's in the Grammy Hall of Fame, don't you know, as far as that goes. It was a country ballad. And it was, I think that Chuck Seals was playing in Wynn Stewart's band at the time. So they were clearly just country guys all the way. And then, of course, Jerry Lee gave it its own style, to say the least.
Oh, yeah. And he also inspired, who was the song Memphis, Tennessee?
Well, Chuck Berry.
Okay. Because Jerry Lee definitely inspired that one.
Well, that's fighting words. I think you could argue it either way.
Oh, yeah, which brings us back to the ATSC standards. This is the standard course for modern broadcast television.
Mm-hmm.
And they're currently still playing with ATSC 3.0, which they've been doing for roughly a decade, and they've been having continued problems with it, but they're still trying to cram it out. And it includes a digital rights management cram down, which is basically the back door to turning off free broadcast television.
Okay.
And also, although it's not supposed to mandate it, it's supposed to work just over the air. But ATSC 3.0 sets have to be plugged into either a separate decoder box or their internal decoder box that's supposed to be able to receive over-the-air rekeying, has to frequently be plugged into the internet.
Right.
In order to update its certificates to allow it to be watched. And everything on an ATSC 3.0 signal, including the emergency broadcast system, is encrypted. So a cell phone, if you're on hard times and you pick up a cell phone in a back alley that works and you've got no subscription, no nothing, but it works, and a tornado warning comes out and the cell phone's turned on, it will give you the tornado warning.
Yes, it will.
ATSC will stick its tongue out and laugh at you as your house is destroyed around your ears.
Yeah. Next-gen TV is how they market 3.0. And talking about combining 4K Ultra HD and all that with broadcast. You know, I don't know because I don't watch television. So, you know, my knowledge of television goes back to when, you know, we had 525 scan lines. We didn't use them all, but nonetheless. And we adopted that horrible NTSC, never twice same color.
Yeah, well, with all the challenges they had, they did far more with NTSC than you would have thought possible.
Well, yeah, but,
they,
you know.
RCA created color that was black and white compatible, so you didn't have to replace your TV set just because your favorite TV station went color and you were still struggling with a $200 TV.
You've ended the hour.
This is the station that keeps you informed.
We're in the news.
Chicago's very own.
Thanks for calling. And okay, online. Bye.
Thank you.
Nexstar Media Group Station.
WGN Radio. I'm not sure what happened to that, but that's supposed to be Bobby Blueblend, Let Your Love Light Shine, and I'll make sure it is next time. I don't know why it didn't start. But we'll, I'll worry about that. But right now I'll talk to Gary in Austin. Welcome back to WGN Radio.
Well, hey, Raleigh. Yeah, I was thinking about a couple of celebrities that
I'm not sure about them. Like Fabian is one. I know he did Turn Me Loose, but I understand he was very, very popular. But I don't know for what.
Was he? They got him because he was sitting outside in Philadelphia, South Philly, on the porch, and they looked at him and said, "God, that's a good looking guy. Let's make him a teen idol." That's pretty much it. But while I left, this was the 70s in Los Angeles. I can't believe I did this, but I probably still would today, but I'll confess. So Fabian gets arrested. True story. He gets arrested for battery, for beating up his wife and his mother-in-law. And later he got a divorce over this and all that. But anyway, when the news broke, my headline was Fabian scores first two hits in years. And
I thought there might be a Turn Me Loose line in there.
No, maybe. That was first two hits in years. That was so every time I think about Fabian, that's what I think of. But no, really, he was a Fabian Forte, and that was actually his name, Fabian Anthony Forte. And he was born in South Philly, and his father was a cop in Philadelphia. And Bob Marcucci was good friends with Fabian's next-door neighbor. And what happened was Fabian's father had a heart attack. And while he's being taken away in an ambulance, here's Marcucci looking over there and sees Fabian. And he thinks, God, this guy's perfect. You know, in the days of Rick Nelson and Elvis and everything else. And so he goes over. Meanwhile, here's Fabian worry about his father possibly dying. And Bob Marcucci hands him his card and said, well, if you've ever been interested in the rock and roll business, and from what I understand, Fabian looked at him like out of his mind. You know, it's like, I'm worried about my dad. What was interesting is his dad, I think, was okay, but bottom line is he couldn't find work. Well, he had no notable skills whatsoever. So anyway, he couldn't find anything. And so Marcucci, meanwhile, is still after him. And in fact, Frankie Avalon actually suggested Fabian as a possibility as well. And so he said, they gave me a pompadour and clothes and those G.D. White bucks, and out I went. They gave him $30 a week to be on the road. And while he was home, he was working part-time in a pharmacy. And he was still practicing singing and I think trying to get his GED or something. I don't know. But his goal was to make money. And he knew that he wasn't good at it. In fact, I think his viewpoint of it was horrible. Well, Georgie Woods played it. And I love the way it came out. For some reason, Georgie Woods played it. Well, of course he did. He was paid to. All right. The song was Shivers. And actually, the interesting thing, there's a Chicago connection because this was a local hit in Chicago. And that is how Fabian met Dick Clark, just down the road in South Philly. And Clark agreed to try him at one of his record hops, which he was doing, you know, off the air, not on bandstand. And he noticed that the little girls went wild. They just thought it was great. And Dick Clark called Marcucci and said, you got a star. Now all you have to do is teach him how to sing. And so they put him on American Bandstand. He did this song called I'm in Love, and it was terrible too. But the response was overwhelming. People just, young girls, thought he looked just great. And he was doing all these record hops and getting virtually nothing for it whatsoever. And on TV, he was lip-syncing the records. And he was still a high schooler. He was like 15 when he was the most promising vocalist of 1958. And then Marcucci didn't give up. And so he got a Doc Pomus Mort Schumann song, I'm a Man, not the Bo Diddley hit. And Fabian kind of liked it. And he tried his darndest. And then the next single was Turn Me Loose, which you mentioned. And, Marcucci took out all these ads, like in Billboard and other publications. Fabian is coming. Who is Fabian? Fabian is here. And, it worked. Turn Me Loose got into the top 10. And that was really about it. Well, Hound Dog Man, the follow-up, got up to number 9. But his biggest hit was number 3, Tiger. So, yeah, it was terrible. Well, they all were terrible. What am I saying? Let's see if I have time. I'm hoping I don't. It would be to my credit if I don't. But let's...
Turn Me Loose was bad enough.
Well, it is. You're right. You're absolutely right. But let's...
It's a great song to make fun of.
Well, sure it is. Yeah, here's Tiger. In case there's somebody who haven't had the displeasure of hearing it.
Hey, lump of sugar, you look kind of sweet. Cuter than a baby walking down the street. When I look into your eyes, I want to leave. I can't conceal that you make me feel like a tiger. Ooh, like a tiger. Ooh, just a sea smile really drives me on the ground.
So there you have it.
Wow. And that yeah, one, I've missed that one.
Oh, well, see, I know that record, actually, and it was a hit, as far as that goes. Turn Me Loose was as well, but Tiger was even bigger. And then they put out, he got gold records for both of those. So they put out a gold album called The Fabulous Fabian. And so by the time he turned 18, he had 11 singles that actually hit the Billboard Hot 100, Most Struggling Under, but there... And apparently the deal was Marcucci actually admitted to punching him once, so their relationship was a little questionable. And he was one of the stars of the Paola hearings, don't you know? And but not about Paola. He testified in front of Congress saying his records had been distorted electronically to significantly improve his voice. Well, I guess... Not that there's anything illegal about that. He bought out his contract for $65,000 in like 1963 and signed with Dot, with Randy Wood from Dot, you know, Randy's record store. And Fabian did not have bad things to say about Marcucci. In fact, he said, I didn't think he ever cheated me out of money. He never promised me anything he didn't deliver. He said the problem was all the songs sounded the same, so I bought myself out of my contract. And, you know, he started to sing and nobody noticed, so he posed nude in Playgirl in about 1973.
Oh.
And so it's funny because he said, I knew it was a mistake the minute I saw the thing was sold in a paper bag. So, yeah, but it actually probably wasn't a mistake because it actually got him as an act at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. And, you know, he had a manager at that point and he was at the Blue Max at the, you know, Hyatt in Chicago. And, you know, it was, I don't think anybody had anything really kind to say about it. You know, they all sort of, all the, you know, critics sort of mentioned his lack of talent, but, his former manager said, you know, he was a sensational lounge act in Nevada, but he shouldn't play anywhere else except on prom nights. And yeah, that's probably true. And he was performing in Las Vegas. He wound up not only attacking his wife, but he attacked the district attorney in Las Vegas. And he filed bankruptcy, and he started performing again in the 80s, but I couldn't tell you anything about it. But so that's the Fabian story.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a lot. True. You don't have talent to make money.
Right. Well, a lot of records. I mean, believe me, this was not for lack of Chancellor records. Marcucci released a ton of things. Hoping for something, and he got Turn Me Loose and Tiger in 59, but after that, I mean, I'd say another 25 records probably.
Wow.
So, yeah, then of course, during the teen idol craze, you know, the TV, you know, the movies and stuff, 20th Century Fox, you know, did so well with Elvis and with Pat Boone, so they signed Fabian to a long-term contract. And this was good for him. This was not so good for 20th Century Fox. He was a leading role in Hound Dog Man. You probably have never seen that. And it was based upon a novel by the guy who wrote Old Yeller. And he sang a number of songs. Terrible, just terrible. And, the film lost money, okay? And then he wound up in supporting roles. He was in High Time with Bing Crosby, and he had a moment in North to Alaska with John Wayne. So the studio kept him because, you know, he said, acting wasn't like singing. It was very private, quiet on the set, no screaming. It was wonderful. So, you know, he liked that, and that was it. And he did a number of things like that where he got to meet and greet everybody from Natalie Wood to Marilyn Monroe and all that. And there was a television series, and I never saw it. He was a psychotic killer in A Lion Walks Among Us, which was an episode. It was an episodic television show called Bus Stop, and it was something Robert Altman put together. And apparently this was highly controversial because it had violent content or something like that. But he said it was his best performance. And then Fox paired him with Tommy Sands in some movie. And then Bob Marcucci got him in some other movie. None of which you remember. But he played opposite Tuesday Weld in one of the Dick Powell Show episodes. He was momentary in Mr. Hobbs Takes a Vacation. So a lot of things, The Longest Day, a lot of things like that. There are others I'm not thinking of offhand. But, you know, he worked, I mean, which is amazing, to have absolutely no known talent whatsoever. He signed with American International Pictures after that and did several things. And so I think that he's been in over 30 films.
Wow,
so
that's amazing.
Right. Most
and they're all forgettable.
Well, absolutely,
like.
Or certainly his role therein, and he got drafted, but this is interesting, and I don't think it's because anybody but Kate off, but he went to the physical and they declared him 4F.
Huh.
And I don't know why. But, you know, he was drafted. He figured it's during the Vietnam War period, too. And he figures, well, I've got my call to duty. He goes down for the physical and they say, ah, no. So, but, you know, he was drinking. And I think that that probably led to the arrest to the wife and the mother-in-law. And, you know, the deal with attacking the district attorney in Las Vegas was actually on a plane, where he was smoking, and the district attorney was kind of a seatmate and said, put out the cigarette. So he did. He put out the cigarette on the district attorney. And yeah, you can figure he was drinking for that. And and that was after the divorce and the beatings. Then he was involved in a charity racing event at Watkins Glen, and there was something where somebody got injured, and he was ruled to be 40% liable or something. So I don't know what the deal was there. There's a story. You could probably look it up. And so, but he's had three marriages, including the ill-fated one. That's the deal. I think the last marriage was Miss Pennsylvania USA. So I don't know. I don't know if they're still together or whatever, but maybe... maybe so. Back in Pennsylvania. So, yeah. That's it.
But yeah, that's interesting. And then another one I was thinking about was the incomparable Hildegard. Now, I don't know what she did, but the first time I ever heard about her was on the Cruisin' 56 album, where Robin Seymour mentions her. And she was, I guess, in...
She was a cabaret performer, the incomparable Hildegard. This is not our era. In fact, long before Nat King Cole did it, she did Darling Je Vaux Aime Beaucoup, you know, that thing. And she it was supper clubs and cabarets, and she was glamorous, had evening gowns and, you know, the long white gloves and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, but I think her last name was actually Sell, but in any event, Hildegard, she went by just that one name. But it was all like supper clubs. But she would have been born like around the turn of the last century, like early 1900s.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. This was, you know, and she wound up performing at the White House during the Truman era, things like that. And I think that in the 40s, she wound up being the best paid cabaret vocalist. She was making like $150,000 a year then. So, but that's also when the music was starting to change. So, that was the deal. And, she lived to at least 80 something. I don't think she ever got married. I never heard of anything like that. But the incomparable Hildegard. I think Walter Winchell dubbed her that. I don't know, but somebody. And so that was the deal. And she died. She was 99 years old, like 2005. Wow. So yeah. she was around. But it was certainly not, you can't even say the pop standards era. This predates all of that.
Right, yeah.
But where did you run in? Who was talking about her?
Oh, it was on the Cruisin' 56 album with...
Really?
Well, Robin Seymour.
Yeah.
And I think she was going to be in Detroit or... I can't remember now. I haven't heard that album in years. But I remember him mentioning, I don't know if she's going to be in concert or...
All right, so that's when Robin was at KMH.
Yeah, WKMH.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Doing Stranded in the Jungle or something. So this was just a commercial for a Hildegard appearing?
It was a commercial.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, I think she was appearing someplace. I don't know if KMH was sponsoring it or what. I don't remember now.
Or whether Ron Jacobs just took some liberties and threw it in there.
Yeah, I don't know. But I think he might have read it live, supposedly live.
Well.
Oh.
He certainly did the recreation live, so...
Yeah, right.
All right, so now I have to try and... I've got those Cruisin' series. It's in a box, like everything else, and I got to unearth it because it just, by 56, Hildegard is at least 50. At least 50.
Yeah, I was saying, now that not having heard of her then, I didn't know... But, now that I've heard you talk about her, she's been on up, kind of up there.
Yeah.
Back then in 56.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, this is, she was in, like, touring shows, like Follies that toured around, things like that. And she had some bit parts in TV shows, which wasn't unusual. So that kind of thing. But... Her real heyday was before that,
Right. So right around the, probably around the World War II or maybe post-World War II.
The last time I saw Paris, it was really before World War II was probably her real heyday. She was interviewed at one time. And like I said, she wore these elegant clothes and these long gloves and stuff. And she said, Miss Piggy stole the gloves idea from me. she did a lot of kind of risque things. And she'd give long-stemmed roses to men in the audience and all that. But it was never, she was never like a smut queen or anything. But she was absolutely a cabaret vocalist.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, I heard about her, I thought, who is she? And I never knew anybody who knew anything about her. So that's
they wouldn't still be alive. But
yeah.
She played piano a bit and but supper clubs and cabarets were her thing.
Right.
And I think we're going into the news.
So, okay, well, great. Thanks
a
lot.
Thanks for calling.
That.
Appreciate it.
An American boy in Paris fell for a lovely mademoiselle. With no French at his command, he tried to make her understand. He loved her more and more each day. And in his own peculiar way, he'd open up his heart and say, Darling, je vous aime beaucoup. Je ne sais pas what to do. Vous avez completely stolen my heart. Matin, midi et le soir, toujours wondering how you are. And that's the way I felt right from the start. Ah, chérie, My love for you is three, three, four. I wish my French were good enough. Oh, I tell you, so much more. Mais j'espère that you compris all the little things you mean to me. Darling, je vous aime beaucoup. I love you. Oh, my darling, vous êtes très jolie. Qu'est-ce que c'est vous do to me? Absolutely, je suis in a trance. Tout le temps, j'espère que vous dream of me un petit peu tout. Ah, chérie, je pense this is romance. Quand nous sommes alone,
WGN Radio, I'm Raleigh James, and there's Hildegard. And Darling, je vous aime beaucoup was written in 1935 by Anna Sassenko, and she was Hildegard's manager, and it turned out that it was in a movie. Now, it came out in 36 on Shellac on 78 on Columbia, but it was in the movie Love and Kisses that Hildegard sang it, and that got to about number 21 in 43. But then, you know, a dozen years later, here comes Nat King Cole making it an absolute smash, and although it got to number 7 in 55, and yeah, it was just terrific. Dean Martin put it on his French Style album, but that's more of a joke. All right, I think. Anyway, that's the deal. So yeah, she had it going on in a generation that was well before anybody who is listening to this show. Dave on the North Side, welcome to WGN Radio.
Hello.
What's up?
I heard you talking about Larry Darnell.
Yes, I played your request, and then I also played his soliloquy.
Yeah, I was listening to that. Did you say that he was a cross-dresser?
Yeah, well, the Dude Drop-In was a notorious club for that.
So was he like a transvestite? Or was
I think he was performing. Whether or not he lived the life, I didn't know him.
Mm. And then you talked about Lou Ross.
The interesting thing is that, and like I say, I don't know whether he was gay or not, but I mentioned he was born and he died in Columbus, Ohio, and he was a gospel singer. I believe he had a marriage in there, but of course that doesn't mean anything, as you well know. But by the time he was 15, he was doing those burlesque road shows, the brown skin models. You can look that up if you don't know. But then he got the gig at the Dew Drop Inn, which is also where, of course, Little Richard was, and he had real notoriety for that.
And he hooked up. Was Little Richard also?
Well, at the Dew Drop Inn, sure, they would have been contemporaries.
Okay,
I understand it's been fully restored, and that I don't know, but it was originally African American traveling performers, but Little Richard improvised Tutti Frutti there, you know, with lyrics that didn't go on the record, obviously. But Ray Charles, Irma Thomas, Fats Domino, it was stuff like that, and there was a lot of cross dressing there.
Interesting. So Little Richard, was he like a trans, or was he just
Little Richard was confused. He was absolutely gay, no doubt about that. But, you know, growing up in the South and growing up deeply religious, you know, Southern Baptist and all that kind of stuff, he was not comfortable in his own skin. And, you know, notoriously had given up rock and roll, to burned his records, to be in the ministry and all that kind of stuff. But, the Dew Drop Inn was, in some ways, it was a straight club, but the woman who was the kind of MC at the club was Patsy Bedelia. And Patsy, by the way, was a he, openly gay black drag queen. And, you know, he was at the Club Desire before that. But, you know, originally they called him female impersonators and all of that. Yeah, so the owner of the Do Drop Inn absolutely thought it was fine because, of course, she was a charismatic host and entertainer. And I'll tell you, some of the people who, in addition to Little Richard, Bobby Marchand. And Bobby Marchand was notorious as a cross-dresser. He was so good. You know, he did There Is Something on Your Mind, the Big J. McNeely record that he did the soliloquy in. You've probably heard that. And he used to appear there regularly. And so, you know, it was several people there as that. But technically, it was not a quote-unquote gay club, if you will. But with Patsy kind of running the show, it was definitely definitely a lot of cross-dressing.
Okay, was it Little Richard and was it Billy Hines? I thought you mentioned, or was it Les? Lou Ross and Billy Hines, something about like the two of them were like a couple
don't,
or something.
I don't know about a connection with Billy Hines at all.
I thought I heard you mention that before, or maybe it was someone else.
No. Don't know.
Can't you remember if it was Little Richard or if it was Lou Ross or.
Well. You know, there was a connection through Earl Hines, I think, more than anything.
Okay.
Lou Rawls performed with Earl. You know, that's classic jazz there. And so Billy was a member of the Hines family, but, you know, you'd think of him more with Earl Hines.
But they were straight. Or they weren't.
Yes, I have no reason to doubt that.
Okay.
That was not, you know. Again, I don't know what these people do personally, but what I can tell you on stage and all, there was nothing of that ilk at all.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I had heard rumors, so I was trying to clarify some of it.
I have never heard a rumor that Lou Rawls was gay ever.
Okay. Well, yeah. So, I know he's gay, but
He was married multiple times, about three times, Lana and then somebody and then Nina. And, I think there were things in terms of if you were to go back there and see, okay, well, at this point he played this character or whatever, that kind of thing. But I would say I've never heard any talk about that, about Lou Rawls at all.
Okay. So, bro, it is more of Little Richard and Larry Darnell and.
Well, it isn't like it now. It, you know, the internet sadly is is just loaded with information. So if you want a story about Lou Rawls being gay, I guarantee you'll find it. If you look hard enough, I'm sure there was something about his funeral or whatever. But anyway, the bottom line is I never heard it, and so you'd have to get it from somebody who knew him better than I knew him, which was actually not at all. I knew he had marital issues a few times, and there were money issues about that, and then there were rifts between the children of one marriage to the wife of another marriage, and that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. That kind of dirt you'd hear about, but in terms of what you're talking about, I never heard it. That's not to say either way, but nope. I would say I would say no.
Okay, yeah. Just like you said, I heard rumors. I want.
Well, there's probably rumors about everything, but I just don't in any way. I wouldn't buy it. You'd have to do a lot to convince me.
Yeah, like I said, I just wanted to do research before I started having discussions with people about.
Well, don't listen to an idiot talk show host. Research it yourself. Look for documents.
Yeah,
get it that
that's
way.
That's what my papa used to tell me. My papa told me the same thing. He's like, don't take other people's, he's like, do your own research.
Right, and especially online, if it isn't sourced, then don't believe it. It's got to be sourced, you know, you've got to be able to see with a footnote where it came from.
Okay. Let's move on, because that seems like a touchy subject you don't really care to talk about.
Well, no, I mean, I don't think there is a subject. There is no subject, so what else?
Okay. How about Stan Freberg? Do you care for him?
Oh, I loved Stan Freberg. He was terrific. Absolutely. He was one of the funniest human beings. Absolutely.
I catch him on the old time radio show every once in a while. They do clips from.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, they did the Elderly Man River instead of the Old Man River.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can get all of his works. That's easy to get. All that stuff is available, and you know, he often found himself paired with Mel Blanc and did a number of things with him, but other things as well. My favorite, of course, was that whole AT&T deal and the direct dialing demonstration, and they took away our Murray Hills. That was my favorite, but there were so many.
Do you know he played on a Bugs Bunny cartoon?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Absolutely.
He played as a tortoise, and the tortoise and the hare, where they race each other, and he's like going throughout. He's got all these different...
Yeah, it was Junior Bear, J-U-N-Y-E-R, Junior Bear. And actually, originally, it was Kent Rogers, and Rogers was killed. Now, this is a long time ago. Mm. This is long before you were born. This was World War II. And what happened was Rogers was drafted, went into the war, or joined. I don't know why he got in the war, but anyway, he was, and he died at the war. And so at that point, they got Freberg to take that role. And the cartoon was What's Bruin, Bruin, you know, B-R-E-W-I-N, apostrophe B-R-U-I-N. And it was their version of the Three Bears. And that's, like I was saying, you know, he was paired with Mel Blanc on a lot of stuff. So he was the voice of Dumb Dog in Foxy by Proxy. Here's a number of things. He did voice work for Walt Disney's company, the Imagineers, that kind of stuff. He played Mr. Busy the Beaver in Lady and a Tramp, and some other stuff. You know, he also, interestingly, he's credited with his interpretation of Pete Puma was the basis of Dawes Butler's voice of Sam, the cat paired with Sylvester in Mouse and Garden. So,
okay.
And you know, he voiced K.G. Coyote, the father of Wile E. Coyote and Little Go Beep.
And, oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And so.
I catch all these cartoons.
Yeah.
I found out that he did this by listening to the Cartoon Channel. They do like a history on some of the stuff, and you know, they talk about him.
He was on Capitol. He, as far as his popularity with music, with records, Capitol signed him, and that's like 1951, and he started doing the satires, and one of the most famous was John and Marcia. And he played both characters, John and Marcia, repeating each other's names. And you can look that up online, because that was a very big thing. And, you know, he satirized Furl and Husky, a Dear John letter that was hilarious. And, of course, you know, Johnny Ray's Cry. He did it as Try. And St. George and the Dragonette. He did that.
Yeah.
You know, that was Dawes Butler, June Foray, and Stan Freberg. Exactly. And there are a ton of them, just a ton of them. But like I say, my favorite was they took away our Murray Hills.
Who was that?
They took away our Murray Hills. That was my favorite.
I have to hear that again. They got one where he was doing a spinoff of TV. Because I guess TV was coming, radio was going out,
yeah.
And he was making fun of it.
Yeah. Well, there are literally dozens and dozens of these. You know, his parody of The Great Pretender by the Platters, or, you know, his parody of Banana Boat Song, you know, the Harry Belafonte thing. And there's, you know, an endless supply of that. And this is a guy whose material is well known. And, he had fun. Yeah. You know, when McCarthyism was big in the 50s, he would, poke fun at that and, parody Joe McCarthy and other things. And so, it's just everything. Capitol would not release a couple of his things. He made a parody of Arthur Godfrey, and Capitol said no, they wouldn't do it. And the reason they didn't, it had nothing to do with good taste. They thought Godfrey would take legal action. And they also, same kind of thing, he was spoofing Ed Sullivan, Toast of the Town. He did Most of the Town. But when Rhino released that box set, they're both in it. And of course, every Christmas, we usually play Green Christmas, which was huge. Everybody knows that, I think. So, and the old Payola Roll Blues, which was, that was the deal. It's a number of things. Presents United States of America, that was the early years. That was big, too. But I'll have to find they took away our Murray Hills, because that whole AT&T thing was one of my favorite bits.
Yeah, I think that's the one I'm talking about. I'd like to hear that again. I was wondering if you could play St. George one too.
Yeah, let me write it down. I've certainly got that on this computer. It's a hit, obviously. Saint.
Yeah, I don't have internet, so when you say I can go listen to it, it's like, yeah, right, okay.
And they took away our Murray Hills, so I like it.
Yeah. I want to say hi to my girlfriend Betty. Hi, Betty.
Hi, Betty. Okay. Yeah. All right, Dave. Good deal. We'll do it.
Okay. Also, I was wondering, you were talking last week about WBBM and the score going from a half signal to a quarter signal or something.
It's not the call letters now, but yeah. I was going to say that's all online too, but anyway. I will talk about that when I've got more time, I promise.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks. Appreciate it. And that's, of course, on FM now, but we're talking about the AM seal. All right. So we'll get to Gene and Dalton. There'll be room for you, too. One more bumper coming up. And, of course, it will be Turn On Your Love Light, which is what didn't play for me before, but I have every hope that it will now. Coming up on WGN Radio.
Took it, darling, and you tore it apart. You left me sitting in the dark crying. You said your love for me was dying. I'm begging you, baby, baby, please. I'm begging you, baby, baby, please. Turn on the light, let it shine on me. Turn on your love light, let it shine on me. Let it shine, 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 let it shine. I want love. I get a little lonely in the middle of the night. I need you, darling, to make things all right. Come on, baby. Come on, please. Come on, baby. Baby, please. Shine on the light. Let it shine on me. Shine on your love light. Let it shine on me. A little bit higher. A little bit higher. Just a little bit higher. A little bit higher.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, so that concludes Jimmy P's six-pack. Yeah, and he said, let your love light shine. Nope, turn on your love light is what we're doing there. Bobby Blue Bland on Duke, 1961, supposedly written by Don Robey as Diedrich Malone. And if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. But it's a good song no matter who wrote it. All right, so there you go. Time is ticking away, and we are going to conclude the show with Gene and Dalton. So, Gene, how are you feeling tonight?
Oh, you know what? You made my night, but you want to know something? You know so much. You read people's minds. When you talked about Hildegard to that gentleman, you know, I just missed Hildegard about two or three times. My mom was born in Sheboygan, and Milwaukee, we were always there. And I loved her music. And I tell you, when I was explaining to Kimberly, she had this song. I said, Jay-Z or something like that.
Yeah.
And as I was saying that, Raleigh, you'll never believe it. It's ironic. As I was telling Kimberly that, you start playing that song.
Yep.
Read people's minds.
Yeah. That was her signature song. She was known for it. Most people remember the Nat King Cole version, but hers was huge.
Oh, and how. And, you know, my husband and I, we kept missing her, you know, when we would drive through.
Yeah.
She was in that one hotel. I'm getting old now. Like when you said, probably nobody listening is old, but I'm 92 years old and I remember her well.
Right.
And I'm so glad you played it. You made me feel good. I've been really, you know, in your prayers for Thea. It's not going well, but you know what? Every day is a day she's here, and I'm praying that something will come up, that those infusions will work. You know, there's hope.
Oh, yeah. Know? Yeah, I hate to say this. You're ending the show, but you're ending it on a positive note. You're always such a breath of fresh air with your attitude. I hope you'll call me soon. And as far as Hildegard, could have been the Blackstone, the Drake, or the Palmer House. And we'll talk to you next time.
It was one of them.
Yep. All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I want to thank you. Ended my night nice. But it just seems so funny to me. It always will. That was ironic as I'm explaining it. You played it. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Thanks. And I think that's it. We're already in the news on WGN, so I'll just say if you're listening to the stream, that's a wrap.
Pistol Quackin' Mama plus Mob Screen and Duct Tape Dark Knight. I'm Grant Marshall, 2020 News. Real news, real stories, real fun. Prop gun, scrappiness is a showgun. Mother of the sneers behind the wheel north of New York City with her 9-year-old in the back seat when something sets off mommy big time. She whips out her fake pistol and brandishes it at somebody cops say before screeching out of there. The law caught up with Nitty Skitty Bang Bang before she got far with her phony firearm. Trigger slap Happy's facing charges. Have toy gun. Will unravel. Dirty slots, one-armed bandit indeed. A reputed gangster's luck looked a little too lucky at a Rhode Island casino, where prosecutors say he and some pals rigged the game by grabbing inside information on slot machine bonuses and jackpots, then timing their play to cash in big. Authorities claim the crew doubled their digital dough to more than $1 million before the house finally caught on. Luck be a shady, and now the jackpot comes with jail bars. Batman busted, a caped crusader's causing commotion in Mexico. A mystery man dubbed Batman is allegedly bagging bike bandits, binding suspected scooter snatchers to lampposts with bundles of duct tape, then branding them with doodled whiskers and thief scribbles. Cops say the tied-up troublemakers are actually the victims, and now they're hunting the homemade hero instead. Holy handcuffs, Batman. When the vigilante needs a lawyer, the plot's officially flipped. And that's what's happening. I'm Grant Marshall, 2020 News.